What is up? Welcome back to the FanCast Movies Podcast. We are a podcast about movies. You can find us on Fandango.com as well as Movies.com. And myself, my name is Eric Davis, and my co-host, Sean O'Connell. We're both on Twitter. We took off last week, Sean.
I'm honored that you had to put the whole podcast on pause. You threatened to get a guest.
I did. I threatened him. I was like, Sean, you're out. I'm getting a guest. Sean was in London cleaning up after the events of Thor: The Dark World. he was picking up some materials. He was joined by S.H.I.E.L.D. But yeah, he was in London, and I did threaten to get a special guest on to talk about some things. But you know what? I did put the podcast on pause so this way we could catch up this week and talk, because we have a lot to talk about.
Yes.
And we're going to start because – so let's start off. I want to hit a few big news stories, top three news stories of the week. So this way you can get your full on what's happening out there. And then we'll get to talk about Hunger Games: Catching Fire. There's a lot to talk about with that movie. We've both seen it.
Which is rare.
For us both to see a movie, usually.
But that shows you how exciting of a movie it is.
It is. It's an exciting sequel. I mean, this is like the last like The Hobbit is coming. Call it the last blockbuster of the year, because The Hobbit is on its way, and whatever the hell 47 Ronin is on its way as well. it is probably one of the biggest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. In terms of fan anticipation and, box office. I mean, I expect it to do massive numbers, but we'll get into that.
So let's talk top three news stories. R2-D2 confirmed as the first official character in Star Wars Episode 7. Really weird way that they kind of confirmed that. J.J. Abrams posted this Twitter picture on Twitter and standing next to R2-D2 and a few other people. And then like 4 days later, Lucasfilm says, R2-D2's in the movie. Sure. We can tell you that much.
It feels like such a non-story. Like, it feels just because it's Star Wars, everybody jumped on it. But, like, is R2-D2 – does your anticipation of this film hinge on whether he was going to be in it or not? Or what does this give you in terms of a vote of confidence?
It gives us really nothing. I mean, I think it was pretty – we assumed, you know, R2-D2 and C-3PO, they're sort of like our Greek chorus. You know, they're always in this movies. They're like the only constant in these Star Wars movies. We had to imagine that they're both in it. I'm kind of a little upset that they weren't both announced at the same time. I feel like without one, you can't have the other.
And Anthony Daniels has been telling anyone who will listen that he's going to be in it as C-3PO. So you have to assume that that's coming next.
You have to assume. I don't even know. I the way this came out, it felt like, was this planned? Like, did they say, let's strategic? I feel like Disney, Abrams, they're so strategic in the way they release news, especially with Star Wars Episode 7. This one just felt like, okay, we'll give you this.
Well, it looked like an unposed, you know, candid shot from the set where, like, you know, it was Abrams sort of standing around. There was R2-D2, you know, right next to him. If it didn't go across the Bad Robot Twitter feed, I might just assume that it was like something that was posted by accident, but everybody jumped on it, as they will for anything Star Wars from now between now and 2015. And then it felt like they had to kind of respond to it, like, yeah, you saw that picture, did you? All right, yeah, he's in it. So
yeah, but whatever. R2-D2 was announced, and that's really the only things we have on this. I know also a rumor this week, Samuel L. Jackson said that Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill hasn't been contacted by J.J. Abrams. And and everybody's reporting this. Why are we listening to Samuel L. Jackson? Is he the casting agent on this film? Like, what does he know? And even if he does know, he knows he's done Star Wars movies. He knows how to toy with fans.
Of course, yes.
And kind of play with the air anticipation. And he's not going to be like, yeah, well, actually, Mark Hamill's going to be it. He's going to be like, he's going to misdirect you. Because he's fun like that. He knows how to play around it. He's like the last person I'd be listening to.
Well, I guess this is the week that he decided to toy with Star Wars fans and not Marvel fans, because Sam has the ability to do that, you know, in multiple franchises, just sort of throw out random bombs and see how everybody reacts. I'm sure he just sits back and watches it and laughs, and you know, because we all scurry and think, oh, what does this mean? Mark Hamill might not be in it. All those rumors that we heard prior to this were untrue. I went to Sam Jackson's point. Why is he doing credit card commercials, Eric? Doesn't he have Star Wars and Marvel money? Does he have to be doing credit card commercials?
I think Sam Jackson just does whatever he wants to do. I to be honest with you, I'm kind of upset he's not on Twitter anymore, because if you're a sports fan, there is no better time. The Winter Olympics are coming up to plug those, and I really hope Samuel L. Jackson is on Twitter, because watching him on Twitter during the Summer Olympics, the last Summer Olympics, was just a treat. I loved watching his crazy tweets. But yeah, you know what? More Samuel L. Jackson is good for me. I mean, I have no idea what he's spending his money on, so it's hard for me to comment on whether or not he should be doing credit card commercials. Maybe he needs to pay off his credit card. Let's move on. Another big story this week, Winona Ryder pretty much confirming the fact that if they do make a Beetlejuice 2, which it seems like they're really, really close to making one, she's going to be in it. And it's going to be a sequel taking place 27 years later after the first one. And her character, Lydia, who, by the way, she channeled in her Frankenweenie performance. If you saw Frankenweenie, Winona Ryder reteamed with Tim Burton for that. She played a little girl named Elsa, who she admitted to channeling Lydia for that role. So it seems like this is a character she still wants to play and still likes playing. And you know what? Winona Ryder back, Tim Burton directing it. Is this Michael Keaton returning? Could this be a sequel? In turn, you know, talking about sequels, we're going to be talking about Catching Fire. Could this be a sequel that maybe will work all these years later?
If all those pieces come together, yes, absolutely. And I think Keaton is the key, obviously. Well, Keaton and Burton, I guess, both have significance to it, but you'd have to get the two of them back. I mean, it's great that Winona Ryder wants to play along with it, but I think that the driving force of a story like that is going to be Keaton for sure. And it just – I mean, it does raise the question of how long is too long? You know, how much time has to pass before you can officially say – we don't want to see this anymore because the characters have changed too drastically.
Well, yeah, and our sensibilities have changed too. Like, I look at Dumb and Dumber the same way, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when you have wacky characters like this, like Beetlejuice, like Dumb and Dumber, and we're revisiting them all these years later. Our sensibilities have just changed. The way we watch movies changed. The way we consume content has changed. And yeah, we look back at these the original movies with nostalgia and fondness, and whenever they're on cable, we watch them and we chuckle. But is this something that we can invest in these days? And is this the type of comedy – like, do they have to change anything about these characters in order to kind of relate to audiences?
It's a really good question, because do you want to see a Beetlejuice, you know, that has shifted and changed to fit, you know, what an audience wants?
Yeah, that's is Beetlejuice going to be taking selfies the whole show, you know, yeah, like quoting BuzzFeed? I mean, like, what's going to happen here? Like, how do we make this character still be engaging all these years later?
But see, I think what it can benefit from is just the improvement in effects. You know, I thought the effects for Beetlejuice at the time were pretty groundbreaking. And now Burton has so many more tools at his fingertips that they can probably do some really crazy stuff with it and really, you know, up the ante on the weird stuff that happens. And if anybody's going to be able to do that, it's definitely that team. But you know what? I'd prefer to see an original creative group get together and try and advance their own narrative. Then when you hear about something like a National Lampoon's Vacation that's going to be told through, you know, the eyes of grown-up Rusty Griswold, I don't want that. You know, I don't want to see old Chevy Chase trying to get his way through a story like that just to revisit a title because we happen to have some sort of association with it. And to that point, I don't want to see young Ghostbusters, you know, interacting with old versions of Aykroyd's character or a dead Bill Murray. Those ideas, they just make me kind of nauseous. So I'm torn between the two of them. If they want to do Beetlejuice and try and update it, I'm all for it. But I don't think that approach works for almost every franchise.
Yeah, it should be interesting to watch. I'm really curious to see how Dumb and Dumber 2 lands, because Dumb and Dumber, next to There's Something About Mary, my two favorite Farrelly Brothers movies. But the Farrelly Brothers, you know, their style, I feel, really lended itself great to the 90s, to the late 90s, when our sensibilities were ready for it. When, you know, when they kind of revived the R-rated raunchy comedy with There's Something About Mary. These days, we're getting R-rated comedy after R-rated comedy after R-rated comedy, and they're can keep upping themselves in terms of the way they deliver jokes. And, you know, I feel like audiences want to see Ted. They want to see 21 Jump Street. They want to see This Is the End. And I don't know if the Farrelly brothers can keep up with that kind of comedy anymore.
Well, I mean, their most recent outputs, things like Three Stooges, have kind of shown that they can't, you know, that they're still clinging to what they do. And you're right. It feels like the audience has kind of moved beyond that. So, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Like, just in rattling off this topic, we've come up with so many films that are on the radar that are hovering around this same sort of approach. Things like Dumb and Dumber 2 and things like Ghostbusters, which still seems like to be banging around. Things like Beetlejuice, where they're tapping into nostalgia. But it'll be interesting to see how audiences respond to it. I'm not quite sure that they're going to embrace it the way that these filmmakers potentially think. And why don't they just, you know, why won't you just move on to something to come up with something new, you know? You don't see the Coen brothers going back and trying to do The Big Lebowski 2. They keep doing something fresh and original.
Well, that's because they're the Coen brothers, you know. I think it has there's a lot of politics at play. And the Farrelly brothers, because they haven't been as successful with their recent outputs, Hollywood may be saying to them, look, if you guys want to make a movie, you're going to have to go and revisit one of your classics. And that's where that's coming from, possibly. Yes. And I'm curious to see how it affects Anchorman 2 as well. Anchorman 2 is not as far removed from Anchorman as Dumb and Dumber 2 is from Dumb and Dumber. But here's another movie that I'm curious to see, you know, where, you know, it's like Dumb and Dumber. It's sort of found itself into cult fame. Everybody's always quoting it and having fun with it. And so now we have a sequel. Can that sequel sort of touch the original and bring back a lot of those feelings that people had when they watched it? So we'll see. And so what was our third topic? Did we have a third one? Yeah, we did have a third one. Bat Kid. We wanted to mention Bat Kid because that was a big story over the weekend.
Not just a big story, the best story.
Huge story.
More invested in this story than I have been in any film coming out. What a heartwarming, unbelievable story that just captured social media in a way that I think a lot of these marketing campaigns, these movie marketing teams, wish that they could. You know, it had that sort of organic, all of a sudden everybody wanted to jump on social media and comment on Bat Kid and follow his adventures. And I didn't know it was coming, but once it started happening, you just saw your Twitter feed sort of blow up on it. It was such an amazing story.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about that is, you know, and Christian Bale said it, we get so crazy about who's going to play Batman and people getting petitions that Ben Affleck shouldn't play Batman. And right. Christian Bale actually pointed to Batkid and he said, see, this is why you shouldn't care who plays Batman, because it doesn't matter. Because Batman is a symbol. And you can put a 7-year-old kid in the Batman suit.
Right.
And the world freaks out. And to that 7-year-old kid, the Batman who was hired to walk around with him all day is Batman, and not Christian Bale, not Ben Affleck. It's just the man in the suit, and that's who's Batman. And so I think it's just it was a really great thing to kind of see, you know, when you're watching your local news and you're getting all these bad news, bad stories coming out. It's nice to see a city rallying around a little kid and sort of making his dreams come true.
Well, and that was my favorite part about it too, was the size of the crowds, you know, of the people who turned out to support this kid. The work that went into it behind the scenes to set up these crimes, you know, for this kid to foil was fantastic. I mean, that team needs to be applauded left and right. But the people who dropped everything, you know, and went down to these events and supported this kid, that was so fantastic. Every time I opened a new picture on Twitter and saw the size of the crowd growing and cheering this kid on, just amazing. And so I think we wanted to talk about it because we're both parents, obviously. It affected us in that way. But what a great example of, as a community, when we can get behind something in pop culture. A lot of times pop culture is just sort of dismissed as, oh, it's frivolous and there's no weight to it at all. But that's wrong, because it can lead to something as amazing and spontaneous as this. And you say, I wish we could see more events like this, but the fact that they're rare and the fact that when they do happen, they're so special, I think needs to be celebrated.
Exactly. Well done, humanity. Moving on, The Hunger Games, catching fire. It's out this week. I'm on fire. Sean is on fire. We are on fire to talk about this film. So let's not spoil things, but I want to kind of come into this conversation from a point that you brought up before we came on the air, in terms of adaptations these days and big franchises, and when big franchises like The Hunger Games are based on books, how that is sort of taking away some of the mystery behind finding out what happens next. When you look at a franchise like, say, the original Star Wars movies, for example, these were original movies that were based on no prior source material. And so when they were leaving us on cliffhangers in The Empire Strikes Back, we were like, what's going to happen next? If you've read Mockingjay, you already know what happens next. So who cares? And is that taking away some of the mystique behind these franchises? You think it is?
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned Star Wars, because that's a perfect example of when we were growing up and, say, Return of the Jedi was coming out. You know, we'd seen Empire. We had no idea what was coming next. And then we'd get these, like, movie adaptation books or magazines, you know, and they'd be 15 pages long. They'd be filled with photos. And if you saw it in a store, in a bookstore, you didn't want to pick it up. You didn't want to flip through it. You didn't want to see, you know, any kind of image that might have given away what was going to be in that movie, because it was going to spoil it. Now, obviously, we're a completely different age nowadays, and you can, you know, try to avoid spoilers online if you want to. But watching Catching Fire, and I'll say I think it was an extremely well-done adaptation. It's very loyal to the book. The production values are better than the first one. The performances are better. I thought on almost every level it was better than the first one. But having just read the book before going into the movie, I got to all these major scenes, and some of them that are supposed to be surprising, and I was like, oh, okay, well, here's this scene. And, oh, yeah, this is the moment when that's going to happen. And it just – I could appreciate the fact that they did a great adaptation of the book, but I was not pulled into the story in a way that I would have been if I had no idea what was going to happen. Now – you said that you didn't read the book, and so it probably worked a lot better on you. But I don't know if these films like The Hunger Games, films like Divergent, films that are going to be based on these young adult adaptations, you know, they do cater to people who haven't read the book, but mainly they're aimed at people who are big fans of the book. And I just wonder if that's a deep flaw of the way that these franchises are being set up now. There's no mystery to them anymore. I feel like there's no suspense to them.
I feel like you can't win this battle. Because if you deviate from the book and create your own ending and create your own scenes, then yeah, the fan base that's sort of your ground control, the fan base that's going to give you your big, you know, big box office, your big record-breaking opening weekends, they're going to be pissed off.
Yeah, they'll kill you.
You know, so I think you have to balance that line of, like, giving the fans a nice, you know, adaptation that sticks to the book. I'm of the opinion that most of the people that are big fans of this book, that have read the series, that are going to see the movie, they are just jacked to see it brought to life, and compare it to what they have in their imagination and what they kind of came up with, and then see what is produced on the screen. You know, I think that you're in the minority in terms of people who are sitting there kind of like, well, I know what's going to happen next, and so ho-hum. I think most of the fans are like, they can't wait to see what happens next, because they can't wait to see what they've done and how they've brought it to life on screen. You know, I mean, we've been seeing adaptations for a long time. Harry Potter went through 8 movies.
Yeah.
You know, and very successful movies that people really loved. And a lot of these people have read the books. And so I think that you can I think it depends on the person. I think you can read books and go see the movie and then get complete, you know, different experiences. I'm of the opinion I like to read books after I see the movie, because I like to see the movie. I like to experience it that way. And then I like to read the book because it colors in a lot of things that maybe the movie did not. And it's almost like unwrapping an extended cut.
Right.
Of the movie after you watch it. So that's sort of the way I like to experience it. But, you know, other people, you know, they read these books before they're even picked up, and they become big fans of them. And so I think it depends on you.
And the Harry Potter example is a perfect example. Even the Lord of the Rings books, you know, I mean, they're huge movies, and they clearly have existed as books for a long time. I guess it just comes back to, if there are characters that I really have become invested in, and I really want to see, like, what's going to happen next in their story. You know, characters that we've grown up on, when sequels would come out, I would be genuinely curious as to, like, what is the next chapter of their story going to be? And so let's take Catching Fire as an example. Like, when it ends, I was really anxious to find out what happens next with this character's journey, with all these characters' journeys. And I've got Mockingjay sitting on my desk right here. Like, it feels strange that I can pick it up and just continue on and not have to wait for Mockingjay to come out, you know, in a year. And especially in this scenario where they are breaking it up into, you know, the last part's going to be two films and they're going to be stretched out over the next 2 years. Well, it has to be hard to maintain that momentum and that interest level, you know, for a book that's sitting on people's shelves right now. I don't know why it struck me so much for this story. And you're right, there have been adaptations for years, and I'm sure this has been a problem for other people in the past. But really, when I got to Catching Fire, when I watched the movie, maybe because I just read the book so recently, I felt this feeling of, I was just here, you know, and I just saw all this stuff in my head. I wonder why it's not pulling me in as much as it, because I do think it's a good movie. I think it's a really good adaptation of the book.
I think it's a great movie. I called it the best blockbuster of the year. And I'm fine
what?
Going on that. Yes, I did.
What?
I did. I called it the best blockbuster of the year. Because I felt like, unlike Iron Man 3, Star Trek Into Darkness, Pacific Rim. Look, we have a lot of fun, engaging movies, blockbusters that have come out. But I feel like none of them have had the emotional depth, as much emotional depth as this film. And even the sequels, I just felt like there's been this emptiness. There's been this sort of focus on creating the bigger and baddest action sequence. You know, let's do stuff that nobody's ever seen before in terms of an action sequence, but we're not investing in character. And I really appreciated the fact that the first half of Catching Fire, remember, this is coming from someone who hasn't read the book, I really appreciated the fact that the first half was just all driven by its characters. It was all character. And then the second half was a lot of action. And so when we got to that nonstop action, we were so invested in the characters. And that's just something I have not felt in any of these blockbusters this year. I have not been as invested in character as much as I was in Catching Fire. And for me, that sort of made it this complete, well-rounded experience that I haven't had watching another blockbuster this year. I've had a ball. I've cheered. I've clapped. I walked out of Thor, The Dark World, with a goofy smile on my face. But I also walked out of a Thor, The Dark World, where I just did not know its villain. I did not really care about its villain. I felt like its villain was a caricature of almost every villain that's ever wanted to dominate a galaxy. So, you know, Pacific Rim. Love Pacific Rim, but there wasn't a lot of character depth there either. So I just felt like there's been this emptiness in these Hollywood blockbusters, partly because, yes, they want to wow you with their special effects, and also because they want to appeal to as many groups and demographics as they can. Catching Fire, I felt like it kind of went places that other blockbusters haven't gone yet, and I really appreciated that for it. And a lot of that has to be attributed to Jennifer Lawrence. I feel like she freaking owns this character in this movie like no other actor or actress has owned a blockbuster this year either, maybe with the exception of Robert Downey Jr. in Iron Man 3, because he owns the hell out of that role. But Jennifer Lawrence, you know, I said in a little thing that I wrote, I said she's on the verge of becoming a revolutionary in this movie. I think she can also perhaps revolutionize the way that actresses are treated in big blockbusters. I mean, you look at the way this girl's going to open up this movie this weekend, and you can't tell me that they should not give other females big blockbusters like this?
Well, you know, they're trying. I mean, they want Shailene Woodley to do it in Divergent, and, you know, they are farming this young community to try and give everybody their own franchise. Like, you get a series, and you get a series. And the thing I love about Jennifer Lawrence is that she can switch gears and also appear in something like American Hustle later this year and hold her own, because you're right, she's incredibly talented. My analogy for her in this movie is that, you know, if everybody in the ensemble is basically the members of U2, they're all very talented. Woody Harrelson's very talented. Elizabeth Banks, very talented. But Jennifer Lawrence is Bono. Like, she's bigger than everything else.
She elevates it beyond where it could go.
Yeah.
I feel like she really helps, because I'll be honest with you, Liam Hemsworth, God, not crazy about him at all. Josh Hutcherson, not crazy about him at all. And I don't know if it's because – and I haven't read the books. I don't know if their characters are more complex and on the page than they are on screen. But I feel like she kind of runs them over. with her performance, and which is a good and a bad thing. I'd like a little bit more out of PETA than we get. I'd like a little bit more out of Liam Hemsworth than we get. But like I said, I don't know if these guys are different on the page and they just don't have time to really explore them in the films as much. But
They're painful to watch. They have no charisma. Like the best parts of the movie is when Lawrence is able to you know, play off of someone like Woody Harrelson, who can bring color, you know, to a role, some flavor to a role.
Exactly.
And that's why I don't know who – I had a conversation with somebody else. I was like, who did Josh Hutcherson beat to get this role? Because I have no idea what he's bringing. Like, PETA is a very complex character in the books, and there's a lot going on in terms of his relationship with Jennifer Lawrence, and that does not make it to the screen. And so, yeah, she has to do some heavy lifting, and thank God she's as talented as she is.
Yeah, but you know what? Really liked the film. A lot of people are calling it the Empire Strikes Back of the Hunger Games series. A lot of people – Catching Fire is their favorite book, and so this was the movie that they really had to land. I think that this film is has not only is it another big YA open, like Hunger Games opened big. Not only is it going to open big for its fans, but this movie also has tremendous word of mouth. It has guys like me who haven't read the Hunger Games books, who aren't big fans of this YA series, you know, YA movie kind of trend that's happening right now. Guys like me are calling it the best blockbuster of the year.
Yeah, that's major.
I mean, it's going to – this movie's going to just go bananas. It's going to go berserk at the box office, I think, for a few weeks. And it'll be interesting to see. And it's going to put a lot of pressure on this next Mockingjay movie, which is a movie that, from what I hear – and I haven't read the books again – but from what I hear, this first of the part two Mockingjay is going to be a little dry. The content is dry. And the action doesn't really get going until that second part of Mockingjay, which if we know Catching Fire, we can kind of foresee what's going to happen in that. So – they're going to come off this crazy wave of Catching Fire, and it's going to put pressure on them to deliver something in that next one, in that third one. The good news for them is that I think that Catching Fire is going to propel everybody to that third one no matter what. And even if they're not successful with that third one, people are going to be like, I got to see the fourth one.
Right.
And then they can really bring it home with the fourth one. So they may be okay. I think they may be okay, but we'll see. I'm curious to see now where they go. But I got to tell you, Sean, after the first Hunger Games, all right. I'm really excited. This is the first YA franchise. I'm really excited to keep watching, and I feel like they're delivering them at they're doing a good job.
Well, it's the Deathly Hallows problem, right? I mean, didn't Deathly Hallows have to really keep an audience entertained just until it got to the part two where all the action, the confrontations are all going to come to pass? Yeah. You know what I love about it is the fact that I think that it's going to prove how much box office power teenage girls have. You know, teenage boys get everything aimed at them. And maybe that's because Marvel is so prevalent nowadays. But, you know, they try and force Jane Foster and Kat Dennings down people's throats and say, no, see, we are catering to teenage girls, but you're really not, with things like Thor and Captain America. But with Katniss Everdeen and God bless Jennifer Lawrence, again, you've got a tremendous role model and a tremendous character that teenage girls can go out and support. But Francis Lawrence wisely, the director of Catching Fire, wisely realizes that he can hit all four quadrants if he increases the character development in all the different characters, brings impressive special effects, but not mind-blowing, just enough to sort of move the story along. And so he has created – I'm with you on this level. He's created a satisfying tentpole film that almost anybody can go to and find a couple of things to buy into and really appreciate.
And invest in. And I think that's big with these blockbusters these days. And I think that's one of the main things that people are criticizing them for is the inability to really truly invest in them and not just watch them for the popcorn value, for the just, ooh, that was a fun roller coaster. You know, I think whenever something with a little bit more meat on its bones, and that's also a big movie comes along, we have to pay tribute to that. Last comment, Sean.
what a difference adding people like Donald Sutherland and Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, can do to a franchise. Because there's no drop-off then when you have scenes with these smaller supporting characters that are going to be important down the line. It's really smart. You know, I've been raving about the Spider-Man franchise. I think it's really smart that Sony has been banking really quality actors in that franchise too, because you know when they're going to play a part later, people like Paul Giamatti, people like Jamie Foxx. People like Chris Cooper, who's going to be Norman Osborn, for God's sakes, you know, then you have these people on your team and they're going to only help, you know, enhance the vision. So
I completely agree. And Sean, I hate to cut you off, but we have to go.
Yeah, we're running out.
Thank you for listening. We will catch you next week and we will talk Catching Fire again next week. Thanks a lot.